I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. In this episode of The Unmistakable Creative, I speak with Scott Barry Kaufman. Scott's scientific work in intelligence and creativity inspires our conversation with him on education, imagination, and analyzing our labels. Before we start today's episode, I wanted to give you a quick update because we're in the midst of planning the next Instigator Experience. We've started to confirm several speakers and much, much more. If you missed out in 2014, this is not your typical business event because it's small, intimate, and leads to real results for the attendees. So take out your phone and send the word INSTIGATE, all lowercase, in a text message to the number 38470, and you'll be able to get on the list and be notified when applications open up. That's 38470 and the word INSTIGATE, all lowercase. Scott, welcome to The Unmistakable Creative. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
It's my pleasure. It's quite an honor to be on the show with you.
Thank you. Well, you know, I've come across your work multiple times throughout the course of the last several years. I mean, all the work that you do over at Creativity Post. And of course, you know, we had requests for you from our listeners. You know, I stumbled up on your book on Amazon, which I have to admit I haven't read yet, but was very intrigued by the concept. So on that note, can you tell us a bit about yourself, your story, your background, your journey, and how that has led you to what you're up to in the world today?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I wrote this book on Gifted last year that I knew that I had to write, and I wanted to get it out of the way before I went on with my life. It was really the culmination of many, many years of reflecting and thinking about our educational system and individual differences, how people differ from another, and how we either appreciate those differences or mute them. And going as far back as possible, my own personal experiences definitely played a role in my thinking about this stuff. As far back as I can remember, I was always very interested in looking at people like on the playground and the classroom. Why are some people faster than others at learning or at athletics? And does that mean those who are slower can never do it? And I was one of those kids who was slower in the classroom. I was diagnosed with a learning disability called central auditory processing disorder. Very young. I had a lot of fluid in my ears. Essentially, the first 3 years of my life, I was deaf. I just heard this like whooshing sound all the time. And I think that was an indication to all the teachers that I was stupid. And I really kept retreating. It retreated into this fantasy world in my head, this really rich fantasy world of imagination and creativity. I would write stories about time travel and act out soap opera plot lines and all sorts of things like that. And I it's funny. It's a funny interaction between teacher and student where the more that I felt as though the teachers kind of gave up on me because I wasn't able to keep up listening to the lecture in real time in the classroom. So the more that I picked up on them kind of starting to give up on me, the more I started the more creative I became in a lot of ways personally, but no one could see that. It really took all the way up to now. I was in special education. They placed me in special education. I remained unquestioningly in the system until ninth grade. And in high school, midway through high school, there was this special education teacher who I think was the first person to really saw me and looked beyond the label. She had never, she was covering for the regular teacher, and she took me aside and asked me why I was still in special education. She noted my frustration at taking this untimed history test that I had to take. And I think she also saw me daydreaming and looking longingly out the classroom. Across the hall was the advanced biology classroom. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to be a part of. They actually wouldn't let me take that class, even though I wanted to take it, because they said didn't think I could handle it. So she really inspired me to try to question the system, and I took myself out of special education and tried on my own to see what I was capable of handling. And I tried and signed up for everything possible, and I didn't do well in lots of things, of course, you know, like Latin scholar wasn't my thing, dancing in the school musical was not necessarily my thing. You know, there are some things that did click, and I pursued those things with intensity. things like cello and the school orchestra. My grandfather, who was a cellist, taught me how to play cello. And psychology, I was really getting into psychology. And I remember in high school, I was reading lots of Howard Gardner and theories of multiple intelligences and really getting into that. And I really started discovering my identity for the first time and worked my way up. There's so much more to the story, but I, you know, after devising lots of strategies to show my intelligence or what I was my capability, I worked my way up to a PhD from Yale, which I got in 2009 in cognitive psychology.
Okay, so you know, having heard it in my interviews before, you know that I'm going to want to dig back into all of this.
Of course, there's so much nuance there. It's hard. How do you condense a 35-year history into 5 minutes? You're obviously just highlighting the thing. You know, you're missing so much of the really important stuff. But yeah. You know, this is as much the highlight reel as I can remember it.
Well, you know, what's interesting to me is that even though you're sort of written off and teachers have given up on you, it seems like you maintain this level of self-belief throughout that almost like you knew that you had a level of intelligence that was there that people didn't recognize. And part of what I'm wondering is how we overcome the labels that we've been assigned in our lives from the people around us based on, you know, past performance and past experience.
You know, labels have been shown in cognitive science to really influence our perceptions of the world. So they can either influence us as we're teachers and or managers, administrators, whatever, or perceptions of other people, or when we're given those labels, they fundamentally influence what we think we're capable of achieving and our perception of our place in this world. So there are deep implications for labels. They can be helpful. You know, we have a fundamental human need to categorize the world and break things up and quickly, you know, and efficiently put things into boxes and labels. If we didn't have that capacity, everything would be this big booming confusion, you know, and I believe that's a famous quote by William James. You know, so it is important in some ways, but in other ways, we have to be sure that we're not reducing so much complexity unnecessarily to a single dimension that strips out all the capabilities of all the other flavors of the rainbow. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Flavor of a rainbow? Maybe that's not a good. I always mix up my metaphors, but colors of the rainbow.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that, yeah. Because what it takes me back to is a story of being in the high school band. And, you know, I don't have any particular natural inclination or musical talent. And I remember the day, excuse me, that I picked up the tuba, and the band director, for some reason, thought I was going to be really good. And he just expected that from me. And
yes,
because of that, I lived up to it.
That's right. Expectations are so crucial. So crucial. There are studies, you know, they're called expectancy effects. That's like the modern term. There were initial studies in the 1670s called the Pygmalion effect. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've heard of them.
Yeah, I vaguely remember it.
Yeah, where teachers were randomly assigned IQ scores from students. And they weren't real IQ scores of the students. They were just given random information. And those that were told by the teachers had higher IQ scores did better academically at the end of the class than those who were told they had lower IQ scores. Even though those teachers did get that information at random, the teachers didn't know that. They thought it was real. Mm-hmm. Shows that there are some holes in those studies and some criticisms, but there's been enough studies now have accumulated to show that these expectancy effects are really, really important. Something that, you know, magnitude of like a effect size of you know, a medium effects, or small to medium, which, you know, if we had any other kind of, there are lots of other variables that have small to medium effects, you know, in the learning environment that we put so much money to public policy to try to remediate, you know, such as reading differences or other kinds of learning disabilities. Yet we don't put much money into trying specifically address the low expectations. Recent study of I think 800 or so special education teachers reported that they automatically have lower expectations that students in their special education classrooms can handle the standard curriculum without even giving them a try. Mm-hmm. That's my point. You know, without even giving them a try, you immediately start with those automatic expectations. Students will do an amazing job of living up to them.
Hmm. Well, let me ask you this. You know, we talked about this from the perspective of labels. You know, many of us have been raised with expectations from the cultures that we've grown up in, from the bosses that we've worked for. And sometimes those expectations are far below our capacity of what we're capable of. So I guess the question is, how do we let go of those expectations and come up with new ones that lead us to better outcomes in our lives and our careers?
It's a great question. So much of creativity and achievement in life is kind of creating this bubble around yourself, insulating yourself from others, the other world, the other people's expectations, other people's emotional contagion. This is especially important for people who, you know, 15-20% of the population are what's called highly sensitive people. Mm-hmm. I think this is something I had when I was young. I think I almost use the word suffer from it, but, you know, it can be very positive in lots of ways for creativity. But I'm very sensitive to other people's emotional states and expectations and perceptions. It's really quite interesting. I mean, if I'm in a room of people who don't think much of me or think just I'm automatically start with that I'm not going to do a competent performance. Hmm. I really do feel stupid. Like I really, even to this day, like that kid comes back, I really feel paralyzed. But vice versa, if I'm with someone who, you know, it's the little things in life that really matter a lot. I think we don't really appreciate that. If you know, someone smiles that I meet, I immediately feel comfortable. And, you know, if it's a warm, genuine smile, I really like people who have warm, genuine smiles. I really like that. And it's like, it makes me just feel like automatically like, you know, cool. We just acknowledge we're both humans, you know, mm-hmm. Awesome. Let's begin. Let the fun begin. So I think to answer your question, I think that it's really important for kids, especially highly sensitive kids who are highly sensitive to people's expectations and everyone is to some degree, is to become your own self-advocate, to insulate yourself, create this bubble around yourself as much as possible where you become aware of your own limitations and strengths. And you don't let other people's expectation so in such a fragile way contaminate that.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's so true. Is insulating yourself from the things that actually won't carry you forward. And I mean, I've thought a lot about that in terms of you know, what is in our environment. I have a friend who actually sent me a document about assessing your environment, and he talked about one which was a virtual environment. He said, you know, look at who you surround yourself with on your Facebook feed. Look at who you surround yourself with on your Twitter feed. Are they inspiring you or are they draining your energy? And it's funny yeah. because we spend so much time in these virtual environments, but we don't consider the impact that they're having on us long term.
It's so true. And we spend so much time trying to get accolades or acceptance from the wrong people, from the people that take us away from ourselves.
I know
I certainly do.
Expand on that. There's way more there.
Of course. I mean, there's our entire lives. We could have 100, you know, people that have open arms for us and welcome us and are just for who we are. And yet we tend to ruminate or obsess over the 1-2% that don't have their arms open. We should spend, you know, for higher well-being and happiness in life, we should spend so much more of our time not going against the grain, but going with the grain of our nature mm-hmm. and those who accept our nature for who we are. I mean, and there's still so much more there, but
Well, I mean, the grain of our nature, that's a whole other conversation, and we're going to dig into that. But let's come back to that. I have a couple other questions. You know, it's interesting, of all things that you mentioned having success at, it was playing the cello, and yet part of your learning disability was a challenge with hearing.
You know, that isn't, it goes even further than that. I ended up becoming a professional opera singer.
Wow.
As well in college. And there's lots of things that would count against me for that. One being that I have a small mouth, it turns out. All my opera teachers told me they've never seen anyone create such a sound with, I have a, you know, like a 0.5 or something millimeter, I don't know, a smaller mouth, someone told me, or I don't know if it's a millimeter or something like that, than the average person. You know, maybe it has something to do with me being born prematurely. The rest of me is just fine, by the way, but my mouth, you know. But yeah, and there's so many things that, like, on paper and pencil could count against me for singing. And it's a common pattern my whole life. There's so many things that should count against me for doing well academically. You know, my IQ measured when I was 10, 11 was quite low. It was actually borderline mentally disabled. And how the hell did I get a PhD from Yale, right? Like, how does science explain that? All sorts of my colleagues in the field try to explain it away. They were like, oh, well, you're obviously high IQ, but you just, you know, like, you were just maybe nervous that testing session or something. And part of my message is like, no, I don't think that's right. I don't think that's true. I think that we need to all recognize that we can all accomplish things not by this compensation model that everyone seems to be working with, that, oh, we're compensating for a low IQ or we're compensating for this. No, that we're capitalizing on other traits, other characteristics that can, by capitalizing on these other things, we can make other characteristics irrelevant.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, actually, that makes a perfect setup for where I want to take this next. Let's talk about education.
Okay, yeah, that's a topic I love.
You know, I mean, I like to joke that I'm a failed byproduct of the education system, just because I did everything that I thought I was supposed to do, and nothing turned out the way I thought it was going to. I didn't get the results that I thought I was going to, and that's largely why I've ended up doing what I have.
Yeah.
And, I mean, education is in such a state of flux. We know there's problems with it. We know it's not leading to its intended outcomes, and given sort of your perspective and your experience, I'd love to hear your thoughts on what the future of education looks like, what the problems are, and, you know, how are we going to fix this?
Yeah, this question so many people are trying to answer, so many educational reformers and I wish there were no, obviously no easy answers to this, and so many people have different agendas of what they think the most important educational outcomes are. Best I can say is what I think are the most important educational outcomes and how to create a system that can enable them. There's such a strong focus in education right now on standards and so like standardized test scores and everything. It seems to be gearing us up so we can get you into like the top 1% university or like the best, because those universities are the gatekeepers to further jobs, et cetera, et cetera. Everything seems to have this very linear system. But what we neglect are things like, which in my field of positive psychology, we neglect engagement, we neglect well-being, fulfillment, meaning, purpose, which are the actual drivers of success in life, both personally meaningful success as well as publicly recognized success. Often, the more that people can get personally engaged in something that's personally meaningful to them, there are higher chances of them having publicly recognized success. We don't need to immediately shoot at the goal of publicly recognized success, or these standards. But I think that instead of shooting for that goal, we should have more faith in the process, more faith that if we equip students with the essential human drives, like satisfying their the most human drives for competence, relationships, mm-hmm. Well-being, need, feeling belonging, feeling creative expression, that these things will come as an outgrowth. And there's so much research showing that these things do come along for the ride, but only when we really relinquish some control over the educational process, over the students, and give them more autonomy in their in their learning process. So yeah, there's obviously so much I could say about this topic. We could talk about this for days and days, but I really do think it's important for if we want to have some really like large scale changes. You know, we need to all sit at this table and have some agreement on what are the outcomes that we really care about. What do we really care about kids in the 21st century having? We always talk about 21st century skills. How many times do you hear that phrase? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's a lot of it is lip service, because at the end of the day, the public policies are not in place to facilitate or promote these 21st century skills.
Let me ask you this. Why do you think we're so resistant to changing education when we know it's a problem, when we know it's not leading to its intended outcomes?
Yeah, who's we in that? You know, everywhere I go, I've been blessed to be able to go and talk to educators, teachers, administrators, and hear their perspective. And I am just amazed by how compassionate they are and how much they want to change. Mm-hmm. I gave a talk in Oklahoma the other couple months ago. After my talk, my main talk, I then was in a special session, a room where I did a Q&A with a packed room of teachers who asked the most brilliant questions and were all like, they were all in agreement, like, we don't want our hands to be tied so much. You know, we see so much potential in these students that we're not giving them this opportunity, and it almost like they wanted a revolution. And when you ask that question, you say, you know, I think the problem is there, that the people that hold the power, who make the decisions, who create the policies, so many of them are so out of touch with the trenches, with the reality of the classroom. Which is why I try so hard to not presume I know it all or presume that I have the answers, but to kind of let the teachers guide me in thinking about what would be better policies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that you brought up the idea that the people who are making policies and people who are making decisions aren't actually in the trenches, and they don't see the real effects of the choices they're making.
And they're not talking to the students either. Yeah. They're not getting the students involved in the process.
That's one that I've always said would be interesting. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Accepted with Justin Long. It's one of my favorite movies, where the guy doesn't get into college, so he creates a college. And what ends up happening,
yes, I did see that.
Yeah, he ends up basically making a fake website, you know, buying this building, and somehow thousands of people enroll in the college and pay tuition. And he doesn't know what to do with all their money. And Lewis Black, the comedian, happens to be the dean. And he says, well, why don't you just ask them what they want to learn? And he appropriates all of their funding towards whatever they want to learn. And to this day, I've always thought, why won't an educational institution, just for a year, take a chance and see what happens if they did that?
Wait a minute. Isn't there another Jack Black movie called like The School of Rock or something, where it's like the same premise?
Kind of. I think The School of Rock is more music based, though.
Okay, one of those two movies I saw. That's mm-hmm. the one I saw with Jack Black in it. And it really inspired. I saw it on an airplane, but like I think I was crying. It inspired me so much.
Yeah. Well, let's do this. Let's go back to this idea of the grain of our nature.
Sure.
You know, for so long we're brainwashed into going against that. You know, there's a point in life, I think, where we hit some sort of turning point where we say, okay, you know what, going with the grain of my nature is uncomfortable. It may not lead to a guaranteed outcome. It's uncertain, and it's very much discouraged by the people around me. So the question becomes, how do I get back to the grain of my nature in adult life, even when it is uncomfortable?
Yeah. I don't know if you're familiar with Robert Greene's work at all.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
He's a friend of mine and really respect his work. His most recent book is called Mastery.
Yep.
And, you know, something struck me. He wrote in there a lot about how we're born with this inner compass, this inner that we keep piling in all these layers and layers of externalities that keep us farther and farther away from that. But as young as like 5, 6, 7, we have this inner like song that just wants to be sung. And that's why a lot of, I said earlier, you know, we need to insulate ourselves and make sure that we listen to that. But I think even as adults, it's very useful to get in tune and get back in touch with that as much as possible. I think things like solitude, reflection, are really important. But we know it's really important for creativity. Solitude is very important for creativity. It's really important to have a return to yourself, as Anthony Storr called it, the great English psychiatrist who wrote a book on solitude, to have a return to yourself and really get in touch with that inner compass, because we do tend to lose it, or it tends to get very, very diluted and weak as other people's responsibility, expectations of our path in life are important. And another a real key to that is also not seeing life as a path, even though all people all around you are taking a path. Mm-hmm. And that can be very hard. I found it very difficult in academia, which is why I've tried so hard to stay out of the traditional path of academia, because I'm so scared of getting on a path and then and forgetting that there or and not seeing all the other paths.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's such a brilliant concept, and there's so much there. You know, it's funny because I have Neil Gaiman's Make Good Art, the book version of his speech, and he talks about this. He said, you know, I didn't really have a career path. I just made a list of things that I wanted to do in my life. And much like you, that is something that I've struggled with a lot, actually, to see, you know, to buy into the fact that, hey, all these people are on a path and I'm supposed to be too. And I don't know that that's uncommon. I think we all feel that to some degree.
Yeah, we really do. You know, I think it's important to pick, like, sit down and write down all the things that you really, that bring you happiness and fulfillment and meaning and purpose in life. And then be a designer, be a life designer. Mm-hmm. Design for yourself a path that obviously can get you an income of some sort,
right.
But you know, there are realistic things there, but that also lets you combine all those things. And sometimes it might not get you income right away, but sometimes, you know, it's good to do that. I can give you an example. My own personal life, I didn't go on the tenure track the path, you know, when I got out of grad school. There's so much pressure when you're in grad school to get on the job market. Mm-hmm. And I decided I was not going to do that. I took a job as an adjunct teaching at NYU and made, you know, maybe like $5,000 to $10,000 a year teaching, trying to supplement. I wrote like crazy trying to supplement my income with like free, what's the word? Freelancing? Yeah, mm-hmm. Freelancing. And I also remained, I was like, you know what, I'm determined that I will write this book, Ungifted, this book I've wanted to write my whole life, and I'm not going to move on with my life. I'm not going to do whatever it takes until I write this book, even if I knew I wouldn't be homeless. I mean, I have parents, you know, who worst comes to worst, and I did end up living at home with my parents for 8 months mm-hmm. as I wrote this book, Ungifted, but I knew I had to get it out of my system and have this faith that when you live with complete authenticity, when you live with complete creative expression that comes from within, that people will eventually resonate with it. That when you put that out in the world, that it will have value in the world. That someone will notice. It's a lot more likely than the opposite case, where you constantly putting stuff out in the world that doesn't have authenticity. So, I mean, it's something that, you know, I eventually, and then five, six years, then this new job just landed in my lap. It never would have been, you know, the great Martin Seligman, one of the greatest psychologists of our generation, founded the field of positive psychology, just basically plucked me up from NYU and said, do you want to run the Imagination Institute? And that opportunity if I was on the tenure track of somewhere else, there are so many other ways in which that story I would have said, I'm sorry, I can't. Mm-hmm. But in a lot of ways, the perfect job for me arised when I just had faith that someday some opportunity would come along that I would be ready for. But you have to be ready for it.
You know, the thing that really struck me out of everything you said there was that this book was something that you had to get out of your system and that you couldn't move on until it was done. And I wonder if we all have something like that in us that really is a calling of sorts. I mean, for me, that was, you know, putting our conference, the Instigator Experience, last year. I felt that I have to do this. And life won't be complete. There is something about this that is so compelling to me and so meaningful that no matter what, if it's done, it'll be a huge part of my life. And it ended up being one of the most meaningful things I've ever done. I always say those are probably two of the happiest days of my life. And I guess what I'm wondering is, can we find that? Is there a way to discover that, or is that an evolutionary process? Is it something that reveals itself to you with time?
I think it's something that doesn't reveal itself right away. Mm-hmm. I think that we need to start. We're so in ourselves that we can't. We often don't see the pattern of our lives or see how it all fits together until much, much, much later. But we have to trust our intuition in a way. Here I go, you know, people might come down on me. Here I am, a scientist, saying trust your intuition. But I think in a lot of ways we need to not just solely rely on our rationality and our what we think is the most logical thing. I mean, it's often the most logical thing is not the right thing for us. You know, that's why we have to bring in our personal intuition, or we have to bring ourselves into this, and what are we feeling about that inner song, mm-hmm. that we need to get back in touch to, that we have in our childhood. And it's very important to constantly flip back and forth between both. I have very little patience, and I have colleagues who are just so hyper rational and logical and evidence based. And it's just a personality clash, because I find that very frustrating, because that's not how I want to live my life. I think that as a scientist, it's important to collect data, and I do. But I'd like to think that as much as I am passionate about assessing reality through data, is just as much a passion I am about using that data to figure out what is possible.
Hmm. Yeah, so true. You know, so let's do this. Let's shift gears a little bit. You mentioned the work that you do at the Imagination Institute, and I really want to get into what that is all about. You know, what the background in, you know, your PhD work was, and how that led to this.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, there's so much in between there, but mm-hmm. you know, and I started to talk about this a little bit earlier when I told you about this path. Like 2009, I got this PhD from Yale, cognitive psychology, and my best friend at Yale, Elliot Samuel Paul, who's a philosophy professor at Barnard College now, he went on the job market and he cleaned up. I mean, he's like an amazing, amazing philosopher, and I think, you know, he got like every job offer imaginable. And I knew in my head that I didn't want to go in the job market. I was like, you know what, I really want to write this book. And so he got this job in New York, started at NYU as a very prestigious philosophy postdoc / assistant professorship at NYU. And I was like, hey, bro, like, why don't we live together? You know, like, I'll figure out when I get there what to do, you know? And he thought, you know, he's like, yeah, oh my God, how amazing would that be for us to, like, you know, live in New York City? And we got there, and he had faculty housing, so it was subsidized. So I was in this amazing opportunity where I didn't have to pay, we split it. It was already subsidized and we split it. So, and I contacted the NYU psychology department, asked if I could adjunct, and they welcomed me there. So I started teaching courses, started, you know, getting some sort of income, and I started having agents contact me. I went through a bunch of literary agents till I found the one that was right for this book. I one of the first one that contacted me almost like a couple months after I just got to NYU, or just got to New York City, you know, City Lights, and I get an email from 50 Cent's literary agent, mm-hmm. and have this big meeting with him, and I saw stars, right? I saw like fame, and you know, he's like, you know, I really want to build my list of celebrity psychologists, and I was, but I started realizing, you know, we started going in a direction that wasn't, that started taking me out farther and farther away from that compass, the book I wanted to write. You know, he had lots of other ideas that didn't sit as comfortably with me, and I had this like heart to heart with myself, and I was like, is this really do I really want to get this far from my inner compass? Do I get this far with the hopes that I write out some book, it does well, and then eventually I can do the book I want to do? Or do I keep trying and get to the book I want to do? And I was very lucky. I got a contact from my current agent, Giles Anderson, contacted me and said, hey, I've read your stuff at Psychology Today. I really like it. Could we, you know, want to have a meeting about potentially doing a book? And, you know, I was like keeping my options open. And I was like, yeah. So I had lunch with him. The first meeting, I pitched the book idea in its raw form, you know, exactly the way I wanted to do it. He's like, what a great idea. He's like, let's work on a proposal. And, you know, I kindly told the other agent, you know, that I said, you know, I really would like to pursue this direction right now. I think I'm going to go with this other agent. And I think he understood, you know. And we, within a matter of weeks, we banked out our book proposal, you know, got a contract, and I was starting to write the book that I dreamt my whole life. You know, I think that there's a lot of lessons there. Mm-hmm. But one main lesson for me has been that whenever I start to feel like, and you can feel it when you're going away from yourself, you really can. There's this uncomfortable feeling. There's this. I think everyone knows what you know what I'm talking about.
Oh yeah,
we're all as human. You know what it's like, and you could start. I could almost start feeling like I could start quantifying the percentage that it's going away from it. And when you start going a sail too far, you know, you're adrift in that ocean, and you feel like you're really losing track of that compass and when where what island you're traveling to. And you stop listening to the calling of those who can hear that compass. So this agent who I am with now, you know, he really resonated with the inner compass, and the best thing for me was going with someone who recognized that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, that's in a nutshell. Oh, okay. And then I guess I wrote the book, mm-hmm. came out last year, and last year I had this, big meeting with Martin Seligman, his grad student, Marie Fogyard, a dear friend of mine, was going to run the Imagination Institute, but you know, she graduated. He wanted her to run it, I think, and she graduated. And he asked her, you know, if she recommended anyone or anything to help give advice. And then I had a meeting with Martin Seligman, and for the first time, and was basically offered the job.
Hmm. So what exactly do you do at the Imagination Institute? Because I'm very curious. And what is the Imagination Institute? Because I'm sure people want to know.
It's a great question. Yeah, we started, launched about 4 or 5 months ago. We got generous funding from the Templeton Foundation. And the Imagination Institute is devoted to the measurement and development of imagination in all sectors of society, business, music, you know, the whole arts, humanities, military, computer science, everything. Mm. We really want to figure out how we can increase innovation and creativity in these fields, increase the appreciation of these traits. Of course, education is a big one, one of my big pushes. And we're going about this, again, with the generous funding of the Templeton Foundation. You know, we just held this grants competition where we're now reviewing hundreds of letters of intent to be funded that we can fund for research on measuring or developing imagination.
Hmm.
And we'll be funding about 15 to 20 of these projects. We're going to be having weekend retreats with exemplars of imagination across various fields to try to really understand their creative process and how we can increase imagination among young people. and maybe have these imagination, hopefully have these imagination festivals, these big public events where people, audience members can come in, and maybe these exemplars of imagination can be can mentor young mm-hmm. people. We can hold like high school competitions for them to be mentored. And yeah, lots of other things in the works.
So that's fascinating stuff. I guess the question for me is, one, how do you measure imagination? And then of course, what can we do to develop it even for further?
So this is not completely new. The field of creativity has existed, going far back, 1950s, Guilford in his famous APA address made a call for more research on imagination. Lots of great creativity researchers have come, E. Paul Torrens came up with a creativity test to measure what's called divergent thinking, which is your ability to come up with many different ideas and possibilities. So there are bits and pieces of ways of measuring imagination and creativity. A lot of these measurements assume that creativity is domain general, that it's something that cuts across lots of different fields of creativity. But there are most certainly domain specific contributions to creativity. What it takes for me to do well as a dancer is probably very different than what it takes for me to be a scientist, for instance, or even within writing, science technical writing versus writing a novel or writing poetry. Very different skills. So there's a combination of very general traits that cut across, like your ability for divergent thinking and your openness to experience and your grit and conscientiousness and your motivation, being motivated. These things that cut across, and they're things that are very unique skills to the field, specific field you want to be good in. And I think the key in measuring imagination is trying to include as many of these components as possible. If we're going to try to forecast the future at all, which is very hard to do, and some would say maybe impossible or futile, but measurements, without measurement, it becomes very hard to know what you're improving,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you want to do large-scale interventions, or you want to really influence public policy and show that imagination and creativity is important, well, we need some sort of metric that, A, we improved this thing that we're calling imagination and creativity, and B, that had a causal impact on variables and outcomes that we think are important, like creative achievement, creative projects, transforming your field, becoming a role model in your field, et cetera, et cetera. So these things, measurement and interventions and development are so intricately intertwined, as you can imagine.
Oh yeah, I bet. Well, Scott, this has been just really, really fascinating, really blown away by your story. So I'm going to close with our final question, which is how we close all our interviews here at the Unmistakable Creative. What is it that you think makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Oh, what a terrific question. I just got a chill when you said the word unmistakable, because that word is a very emotionally resonant, powerful word that I think vibrates at the core of authenticity and of your core being. I think when someone is unmistakable, they have, in the words of what we were talking about earlier, have created such a strong buffer against them and others' expectations and perceptions that they are being almost completely driven by their authentic values and drives.
Wow. I love that. Well, Scott, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share some of your insights and your story with our listeners here at the Unmistakable Creative. I mean, this has been really, really eye-opening and insightful and inspiring, as I expected it would be.
Thank you so much. It was really, again, an honor to be on the show.
Yeah. And for those of you guys listening, we'll link up everything that Scott has mentioned in the show notes. So come and visit the website and we'll wrap with that. If you like what you heard, the greatest compliment you could give us is to share the show with a friend and let people know what you think by leaving a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening to The Unmistakable Creative.